The Rams are back where they belong, where it all began in 1946. The last 20 years have been a bad dream. Now, it's time for the Ramble On Podcast. Here are your hosts, Steve Mason and Ryan Abraham.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Ramble On Podcast. This is our third episode. I'm your co-host, Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com. We got Steve Mason from ESPN Los Angeles. Steve, how you doing, man?
Great, man. Great. Excited. And episode two, I thought was spectacular, but I'm pretty sure this one is going to be the best episode yet.
Yeah, I think we don't want to oversell it. You know, it's our third episode. But
no, not at all.
The Ramble
not
On Podcast, you can go to ramsrambleon.com if you want to check it out. We're on iTunes now, so you can download it on iTunes or your favorite app you want to download and listen to the gym or whatever. You can do all that. Our website is laramsreport.com, and you can follow us at LA_RamsReport. Steve Mason's Venice Mace. He used to be LA Mace. I'm Inside Troy. And our guest, that's why it's going to be a good show today, we have super agent Lee Steinberg coming to you, going to talk about the LA Rams and the impact on Los Angeles. He was born in LA, went to Cal undergrad and law school. So I think he was student body president up there, but he's represented number one picks 8 times for the NFL, done a ton of charity work, a lot of stuff to do with the Rams. So we want to welcome Lee Steinberg, and you can follow him on Twitter at Lee Steinberg. Lee, what's going on, man? Thanks for coming on.
Oh my goodness, I think I died and went to heaven. We've got the Rams back and you've got Rams Ramble On. What could be more thrilling?
You got to hear the intro too. We got the Led Zeppelin Ramble On. That's pretty good. Steve put that together.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah,
no, they're actually here.
Isn't it amazingly? I mean, you know, you and I have both been, well, you of course here your whole life. I've been here for 25 years. I grew up a Rams fan and all the way in Ohio. And, you know, loved the Rams of the 70s. And the couple of years after I moved out here, bam, they're gone. And I remember you from that era. You were part of the crowd that was really pushing to keep the Rams in Los Angeles. Sort of describe that time and the way we actually lost the team in the first place.
Well, let's start by saying that the way I fell in love with football was with my father taking me in the 1950s to see the LA Rams play in the Coliseum. Now, we sat in a dollar seats, and you probably would need the Mount Wilson telescope to actually be able to identify the players from where we sat, but we loved it anyway, and it was John Arnett and Crazy Legs Hirsch and Ollie Mattson, and always had a great quarterback from Norm Van Brocklin to Roman Gabriel and on. But anyway, fell in love with them there. And in 1993-4, it became clear that the Rams were executing a program where they were diminishing all of their outreach. They were creating a desert and then using it to justify the fact there was no support. And they had traded Eric Dickerson, LA Love Stars. So we put a committee together to save the Rams. Jack Lindquist, who's the president of Disneyland, and I got 135 businessmen together. The Rams simply wanted to leave, and the big incentive was a $30 million. It's like Dr. Evil, $30 million in upfront payment, which is absurd in today's economics, but Georgia Frontieri had lost her husband, wanted that money, and that was the motivation to leave the second largest market. So we put together a stadium plan called Sports Town, which would be a Disneyland of interactive rides, which would have virtual reality, high-tech sports-themed rides, and would surround Anaheim Stadium. So you'd have Monday through Friday, Saturday, Sunday, full-time activity going on there with hotels and retail, so you could justify putting the plan together. So we were able to win the first vote for when the NFL met in Arizona, Phoenix that year, and we defeated them. We came back around, and in the interim, Orange County had gone bankrupt. At the time, I said repeatedly, look, if we lose the Rams, we're likely to lose the Raiders. And if we lose both teams, it will be forever to try and get a team back. People scoffed. They said, oh, you're crazy. The NFL can't exist without the viability of the second largest market. They can't do a TV contract. Good riddance. Georgia's a witch. We don't want her. Al Davis, there's gang fights breaking out inside the Coliseum. We don't want them. Get rid of them. We'll have a team back next year. The price of the stadium we were proposing was $145 million. And that's what it would take to construct it. So here we are 20 years later. And let's be clear, it was never the NFL that wanted Los Angeles to remain vacant. It was the lack of political leadership, the lack of one viable site that kept us bereft of football.
Lee, how did you end up being the co-chairman of the Save the Rams committee way back then?
Back in 1992, Mayor Jordan of San Francisco had called me because that baseball team was headed to Tampa Bay and they'd signed a sales agreement. And he said, I don't have any help. I was had lived half my life in the Bay Area as well as Los Angeles. So I helped him. We turned the tide, saved the team. I got sued for $3 billion by Tampa investors.
Wow.
Talk about blood out of a turnip. And then I went to did the same thing for the mayor of Oakland. So I had been involved in that. And when I saw this happening, I said, wait a second. We're not just going to sit here and let them take our team. Let's fight. So I did an interview, I think, in the Orange County Register and said, we got to do a committee. And very quickly, people came out of the woodwork and we had our committee because I think that if you see a problem, you better go out and try to fix it. And what I do professionally in terms of representing athletes is different than the fact that I was living in Orange County. And I thought, you know, it would be very bad for Southern California and for the county and for all the Southland. And plus, it broke my son John's heart, who was, I think, 8 at the time. And he didn't understand. He thought, well, this team is as much a part of the fabric of Southern California as Disneyland or the beach. How can you just have it leave? So I've never favored breaking young fans' hearts. And so we fought very hard. We were up against $30 million as the great incentive. And so while I feel bad for the young kids in St. Louis that feel bad over losing the Rams, they never should have stolen them in the first place.
Yeah, what do you say now to, for example, the fans in St. Louis? You know, I always believe that, you know, what we're talking about with NFL teams, it's a public trust. Fans are essentially, when they buy their tickets, they're buying stock in the team, and it's very emotional stock. How do you, in your head, square the idea that the team has actually up and left St. Louis?
I don't. I go all the way back to the fact that we would have been just as happy in the 50s if they'd moved expansion team here instead of the Dodgers like they did with the Angels. Now, I love the Dodgers, ironically, to help save the Giants, but the point is we'd have been just as happy, and they probably could have put an expansion team in here. So I didn't advocate pulling the team out, but the point is, poetic justice-wise, it's the best. So I bemoan the fact that we broke young fans' heart. They could have put a stop to this years ago when Baltimore pulled up stakes and went to Indianapolis. The commissioner should have just said no. When Bill Bidwell left St. Louis to go to Arizona, they should have just said no. Then when expansion came in 1995, instead of giving teams to St. Louis and Baltimore, what they did is they gave them to Jacksonville, the 55th largest market, and to Carolina, which was like 35th. And that left Baltimore free to steal Cleveland, and that left St. Louis free to steal the Rams. So around and around and around you go. And so I don't think it's right, but look, here's the point. This has always been about franchise value. The Rams, along with the Chargers and the Raiders, are among the 5 lowest value teams. And by moving here into a market with 18 million people, they will almost certainly double and maybe triple their franchise value. And the state-of-the-art stadium that they're moving into is a model for every other team that wants a new stadium. It's got revenue flowing out of every piece of concrete. It's got a massive amount of luxury boxes. It's got a massive amount of premium seating that people can pay a couple hundred dollars to get someone to come to your seat, serve you, go watch TV. It's got naming rights. It's got going to have a jumbo scoreboard. It's got sponsorship. And to be in this market with local TV and radio rights and a ton of people, I mean, 45 million people play fantasy football now. To be able to have the entertainment industry here, 70,000 fans, they've already have 50,000 to 60,000 people willing to put down money for seats. The Rams have a following here that never gave up, and they fought really hard. There's some local groups here that deserve kudos, because when the Rams came out to play Cowboys and scrimmaged them up in Thousand Oaks, what happened was that they sent some league officials, and they sort of wanted to see what would happen when the Rams came out to, and they were stunned because there were hundreds and hundreds of Rams fans in full regalia. And I went down one Sunday morning to the Coliseum, and there was this massive rally that I spoke to. Well, I mean, you can't get hundreds of people on a Sunday morning in Los Angeles to do anything but jog, you know, and have bagels. But the point is that you could see the intensity of it. So the local groups were really helpful in fighting to get their team back, and now they have it, and good for them.
Yeah, we had Tom Bateman on, Lee. He's the director of Bring the Rams Back to Los Angeles. So he actually
great.
Yeah, he talked to me about you when you came down and spoke with them. So he really was appreciative of that.
They're great.
Yeah. You're talking about the values of like the Raiders and the Chargers, saying that they could double or triple by moving to Los Angeles. Sounds like it to you, you're guessing that one of those teams eventually does move to Los Angeles as well to join the Rams.
So I wrote a year ago, back in January of 15, that I thought that the Rams were coming back and that the league would force a second team to be the Chargers, even though the Chargers had their own plan. I still think that's what's going to happen. This was Jerry Jones' biggest power moment ever in the league. Because what happened was Stephen Ross of the Dolphins, Dan Snyder, some of the newer owners, by newer the last 20 years, who have massive fortunes, felt like that the Rams were the right team to come back into this market and establish value. They have a very sophisticated front office. We gave Kevin Demoff a humanitarian award at my Super Bowl party last week. Very sophisticated. They have Bob Reif. If you actually look at the way they market, do social media, very sophisticated. They're going to know what to do in this market. Very wealthy owner. So they felt like that stadium plan was the one that every other team could use. So they got behind him, and then I think they pushed Spanos really hard to be the second team there. So when I saw that vote come up in Houston, where the committee in charge of the LA situation voted for the Carson project, I knew that was not happening, because the more powerful owners have wanted this. The problem is, I wish the Chargers would stay in San Diego, because I believe that they've had loyal fans there. There's dysfunction between the city and the Spanos family. There's plenty of blame to go around. But the point is, I don't think they're going to get that deal done. But they should get it done, because the Chargers belong in San Diego. I don't think that's going to happen. I think that they'll end up, because of having this opportunity to be in this stadium. Remember, will they be the second team? Yeah, just like the Jets are the second team with a pretty high valuation. Will they be the second team? Yeah, like the Angels are the second team who also do very well.
The big factor here is that, you know, and you're talking about valuation of franchises. I mean, Alex Spanos bought the Chargers for $59 million when they were the San Diego Chargers. Now, Dean and John ultimately have a chance to move the team to Los Angeles, and all of a sudden it's a $2 billion franchise. I mean, it's really hard to imagine that they're not ultimately going to do that, isn't it?
I agree. And I think that people that argue that they don't have a natural fan base and the rest of it discount the fact that we haven't had a team in L.A. They show more Charger games here than the proportion would otherwise be. They already have 20-25% of their fan base in Southern Orange County, in the Inland Empire, and some still in Los Angeles. And we got 18 million people here. Now, in 2 hours on a Sunday afternoon, you can get to a site, and it's only 10 concert dates. If you want to think of it, it's not like moving a baseball or a basketball team. So they'll do just fine here. But both teams need to do what the Dodgers did when they moved here, and the Angels, which is they marketed Southern California like it was Des Moines, Iowa. They have to reintroduce the players. They have to reintroduce football. There's about 20 years of millennials who haven't grown up with it. But in the interim, football's become the most dominant sport in the country. LA loves stars. We are a star city. You know, we're a city where Kobe Bryant still fills, you know, a horrific Laker team still sells with, you know, Chris Paul and Blake Griffin and Mike Trout, and we've always had stars. So they need a good-looking quarterback on both teams, you know, or a running back. They need stars. That sells in L.A. But they'll get a few years where they don't have to be just great, but they have to market. When the Dodgers came here, they had AAA nights and Kiwanis nights and Boy Scout nights, and they built into the community, which is why you go to a Dodger or an Angel game. You don't go to see the other team. You don't necessarily go to see the pitcher. You go for the experience. And they have to build the experience of going to the Ram game and the Charger game into a really special afternoon.
You know, Lee, you want to hear something crazy? We do a lot of research at ESPN, and we were recently in a research, I guess they were downloading us on a bunch of research they've done, and they found out that the, of course, Los Angeles is a Lakers and Dodgers town above all else, but the most popular sport in Los Angeles, according to all of ESPN's research here, is still the NFL, despite the fact that we have not had a team all these years. I mean, the power of the NFL in Los Angeles is huge, despite the fact that we, you know, have been franchised less for 20 years.
If you look at the Nielsen ratings, what you'll see is this, that many weeks, half of the top 10 rated shows are NFL nighttime football, which means that football in America, which is a pregame boring show, unless you're a real hardcore person, outrates over 90 other forms of televised entertainment. So we've come to the point in our culture where the NFL is not only the most popular sport, it's the most popular form of televised entertainment. It is dominates culture, and Los Angeles is not immune from it. So if you have 45 million people playing fantasy football, I can tell you when the fantasy draft is, because in the same way that you know when proms are because you see a bunch of young kids dressed up with limos and tuxes rolling around, you can see a bunch of determined young men heading for different locations right around when all those drafts happen. And so the culture is obsessed with pro football. We haven't been immune to that in the national game. But I'll tell you what research will show. Nothing draws better than a popular local team. So wait until you see the ratings if the Rams become a great team and recapture this local market. That's going to be something amazing.
Hey, Lee, for the Rams, and you see like the Lakers being able to pick up high-value free agents because of the location. Do you think that changes the free agency strategy, I guess you could say, for the Rams moving from St. Louis to Los Angeles?
I think it helps. Let's break that down. So the old myth that endorsements flow to the big market cities is just that, because the fact of the matter is that LeBron James in Cleveland, you know, it sits atop the endorsement market, as does Kevin Durant in Oklahoma, KC. Aaron Rodgers does just fine in Green Bay, which has 130,000 people. The point is that these games become national. Los Angeles, rarely, if ever, in the 42 years I've been doing this, has had a local radio show with an athlete on it, his own show, or a local TV show, where the Chicago Bears in 1985 had 14 players had their own radio shows.
Wow.
Or a city like Washington, D.C., and 6 players had either a cut-in or their own television shows. We've never been quite like that. But there are going to be people who, for the weather, the lifestyle, like this place better. There are also players who like to hunt and fish and don't want to be in a big city. But if you look at where athletes actually live, when they're given the choice, the biggest swath of them are in Southern California, Arizona, Florida, Texas. I mean, so for lifestyle, it will be a draw. And for young men who want to party, yes, they would rather be in Southern California than in Northern Wisconsin. So, net-net, it's going to be a benefit.
You know, Lee, I guess now we start thinking about, the team itself, and you have always represented some of the greatest quarterbacks in the game. That is a huge issue in today's NFL. I mean, you really don't go anywhere without a quarterback. The position is, it's kind of a non-starter if you don't have that guy. Talk about how the game has changed. It's always been about quarterbacks, but now it seems like it's even more so, don't you think?
If you go back 30 years, the game was two-thirds running and a third passing. Now it's a quarterback-centric game. It's a pass-first game. Yes, it's helpful to have a good running game, but without a franchise quarterback, someone you can build around for 10 to 12 years, someone you can win because of rather than with, and someone who most critically can elevate their level of play in a adverse situation, you know, thrown two picks, they're behind, and can compartmentalize and adopt a quiet mind to elevate their level of play and take a team on their back to and through that game in the playoffs to the Super Bowl. Without that player, they will flounder endlessly. And the only sure way to get that player, the surest way, is to pick them at the top or somewhere in the first round. Now, there are other routes. You can do a Tom Brady, or you can do a trade like we saw happen with, a Brett Favre or Mark Brunell, or players like that. But if you look at the last Super Bowl, it was two players that were first picks in the draft, and the two teams lost before that. One of them was Brady, and the other one was the first pick in the draft. So the reasoning goes, do you ever want to be this high in the draft, wherever you are in the first round, again? And if you don't, even if there's a higher rated position player, you better go ahead and make that investment on the quarterback now. And here's the problem. Because of the salary cap, preventing you from having an aging veteran who can tutor a younger quarterback along, the problem then becomes that these quarterbacks who get drafted reasonably high in the first round have to play, and they're not ready. They can't see the field right. It just takes time. And because of viral media and everything else, they'll go three or four games into their rookie season and they're judged to be a bust. So if you're not careful, if people had given up on Cam Newton, whatever he did in the Super Bowl, he wouldn't have been Cam Newton. And so it's a difficult process getting a quarterback through, and you're going to have to insert him somewhere so he starts going through the learning process. And you better do it now. So for the Rams, they need the position. They have other needs, but this is the time for them. It's the time for Houston. It's the time for Philadelphia. It's the time for Dallas to tuck a quarterback in there. For the future with Romo, it's the time for Cleveland. And depending on what Chip Kelly thinks he can do with Kaepernick, it's a time for San Francisco.
Hey, Lee, so you represent a real hot prospect right now, Paxton Lynch. Unlikely that he would fall to number 15 where the Rams are picking, but I know you've studied the beginning of the draft. If you want, we can talk about Paxton too, but just who do you think would be available for the Rams at 15 if they did want to go to get a quarterback?
So what we don't know yet, and you can take these draft prognostications and shove them. I remember back in the year 1995, Mel Kiper put a player named John Walsh on the cover of his book, meaning he thought he'd be the first player drafted. And it was this time 20 years ago. And I felt disconsolate because I had signed Rob Johnson. I couldn't sign Walsh because of that, so I signed a guy named Kerry Collins. So we get down to the draft. Kerry Collins would have been the first pick. They trade. He's the fifth pick, and John Walsh goes in the seventh round. So you can take these things because they're crazy, because scouting hasn't even begun except for someone who played in the Senior Bowl. So you've got this group that's Paxton, Jared Goff, Carson Wentz, all of whom I consider franchise quarterbacks. Evidently, Houston has a love for Christian Hackenberg. You've got Connor Cook somewhere in that mix. So you've got three outstanding prospects and two others that could go in the first round. And so it's a matter of who falls in love with who. And these players, Steve, are going to be taken higher than their draft grade would indicate. I'll give you an example. In 1989, Troy Aikman was in the same draft as Deion Sanders, Barry Sanders, Derek Thomas. I mean, Hall of Fame players. But he went first because he was a quarterback, even though they were higher rated. So they're going to go quick off the board. And draft order doesn't matter, because if you have a team that has a hankering for one of those names I mentioned and they are worried that someone else will take him, they'll trade picks and move positions to move up to take him.
Let's talk about your it seems like there's kind of a top shelf of quarterbacks, at least from everything I've read. Your guy, Paxton Lynch, is one of them. Jared Goff from Cal, who I've seen play a lot and is kind of a prototypical, a pocket passer. And then Carson Wentz, who you mentioned, who is, a subdivision. I mix this up now. Is it subdivision? FCS, right? He's an FCS quarterback, two-time national champion and twice the MVP of the FCS championship game. And those are, it seems like those three guys are kind of the top three on the list. Compare your guy, Paxton Lynch, to Wentz and to Goff.
I don't think they're totally comparable. Paxton has the highest upside. they're not comparable because Paxton fits into the new vogue of quarterback, which is Cam Newton, Ben Roethlisberger in a way. Paxton Lynch is 6'7", and his hands are almost a foot long. They're like 11 3/4 inches long. He's huge, and like a Cam Newton, they have a point of view that's way above the crowd and a high release point. The thing about them, though, is they can get outside the pocket and run. Now, Paxton can run better than Roethlisberger. Nobody runs better than Cam Newton. And so it makes them devastating because they can throw off the run. And when they get hit, they don't necessarily fall down. And they can elongate on third and long to get across the line. So the question you have with any quarterback who's been in the spread, which is what a lot of colleges run, or the shotgun, is, you know, can they get out from under center? And so a lot of what Paxton's working on in scouting right now is 3-step drop, 5-step drop, 7-step drop. Mariota had the same issue, and so you just show that at the combine. But he's got the highest upside when he gets going. I mean, he's a beast. And they had some problems in the bowl game at the end of the year, which was not a great game, but their coach, Justin Fuente, had left, and they had really disorganized practices. They didn't have a great game plan. They came up against Auburn, and then they just got smashed. But the situation with him is great kid, good family, smart, adored by his teammates who just loved him. So he's going to be a big, big winner. Is he as totally polished, you know, maybe as Jared Goff, maybe not. But he'll get there. And, so it's, you're really choosing between different types of columns there.
Hey, Lee, last thing for me. You had mentioned that the humanitarian award you gave at your Super Bowl party went to Kevin Demoff, obviously the LA Rams executive. Maybe you can kind of talk about that a little bit. I know there were some famous Rams that were at your Super Bowl party up there. It seemed to be a lot of big names I saw on Twitter, but maybe talk about Kevin Demoff, that award, and some of the Rams that were there.
So Kevin and the whole Ram organization is sort of incredible in a lot of ways. I had a player drafted by them a couple of years ago. One of the things they do is a family day, which no other team in the league does. They actually invite the parents of the draftees to, while they're there in sort of the mini camp weeks before training camp, they have the parents come up. They show them everything the players do. They walk them around. They take them to practice. They take them to a chat with Jeff Fisher. I mean, it's just another step that's pretty cool. And they're really active in the community. So one of the things Kevin did was Demoff's Dreamers, where he brought a whole series of kids to games that otherwise wouldn't be able to afford it, which we sort of liked. He was COs for cancer. I mean, he just had this long list, and it's sort of funny because I knew him as a kid, because I knew his father, Marv, who's a longtime agent, lawyer. And it was just sort of stunning to think that that little kid just helped engineer and pull the whole thing off. And but anyway, we had a ton of players, Rams, but we, you know, we had Troy Aikman and Warren Moon and Jake Plummer and Cordell Stewart and Chuck Liddell, the UFC fighter, and the players are fine. That guy scared me.
Well, listen, we could not be more excited that the Rams are back. I am personally thrilled. I'm one of those people that put down my money to be in line for season tickets, Lee, and I know we'll see you around the Coliseum this year. By the way, I love the fact that they're playing at the Coliseum.
I know, very successful when they were in Anaheim, but to me, the Rams at the Coliseum makes perfect and complete sense. I love the history of the Coliseum, and I can't think of a better venue for them to play while we await the brand new stadium in Inglewood.
It's nostalgia to the max. It's so cool, and I think it's going to do a lot for bringing Los Angeles back together. It's nothing is better. And anyway, thanks so much for doing this show. It's Ram fans are going to eat it up like candy.
Well, Lee, thank you.
Yeah, we love hearing from you, Lee. Thank you very, very much.
Okay. So long, guys.
Thanks, Lee. Follow him on Twitter at Lee Steinberg. Steve, good stuff. That was a lot of fun talking to
Yeah, no, Lee's a fantastic guy, and I'll tell you, he has been in the middle of some of the greatest quarterback careers in all of history. And yeah, I mean, if you look at the quarterbacks who are available, I mean, I think Cleveland's probably going to go quarterback near the top of the draft with Manziel gone. A lot of people think that Jared Goff is potentially the first quarterback that goes in the draft. But there's some conversation now that Carson Wentz may actually be the top quarterback in the draft. You don't know who's going to fall to the Rams at 15. And, you know, maybe they go for their explosive wide receiver play at 15 and instead look to the free agent market for a quarterback. It's interesting because, you know, the Redskins negotiations today with Kirk Cousins have broken down. Kirk Cousins, to me, is a rising star in this league. Maybe he's on the market. If the Broncos use the franchise tag on Von Miller, maybe Brock Osweiler is a possibility. Last week when we talked to Nick Wagner, Nick Wagner mentioned specifically Ryan Fitzpatrick. Ryan Fitzpatrick is not, you know, not the greatest name that I've heard. I don't think he's going to, you know, get everybody's heart going and, you know, pulse racing, but you know, he's a solid guy, but the Rams could try to draft a quarterback or they could look to the free agent market or trade. As Lee said, you know, it's a very, very inventive front office. So it's hard to predict exactly what they're going to do.
Yeah. And I love what Lee said is just, it's hard. You can't just predict it. You can't put a list up and say he's one, he's two, he's three. If a GM somewhere falls in love with a guy, he's going to do whatever he can to get up there and get them or however he needs to do it. And the Rams could do the same sort of thing. There's a lot of options there. I kind of feel with you, like maybe you go receiver and just kind of stay at 15. It just seems whenever you trade up, you lose a lot, you know, and it's for me, just looking at the NFL draft stuff, it always seems like the team that trades up is getting the worst end of the deal for whatever reason. Now you get the guy you want, I guess that, but it's just, the guy you want doesn't always work out that way. It seems like the teams like the Patriots, they're always ones trading down. They always seem to do better on that end.
Well, and remember Les Snead and the Rams traded down in the RG3 deal and got a king's ransom, really, added to that roster. I think they got three number one draft picks in that, RG3 deal. So, the Rams have at least this front office has indicated through history that they're more likely to trade down than trade up. I mean, they're right in the middle of the first round. So I don't think this is a position where they trade down, but you're right. They're probably less likely to trade up for a quarterback. And there are some good solid quarterbacks that are potentially available on the free agent market and via trade. So they can, certainly right now, if I was to guess, I say they don't draft quarterback. What do you think?
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. I like that. I like that philosophy, and it's a winning philosophy where how did the Dallas Cowboys get built? I mean, they traded away Herschel Walker for like 100 draft picks, and they were, you know, they get all those guys and, you know, Emmitt Smith, everybody, and they've been good ever since. So I like the fact that you're willing to do that. And at 15, yeah, maybe you could trade up and get someone you want, but you could, you know, there's a decent shot of getting someone from free agency, from getting someone in the second round that, you know, you could feel, you know, if they feel comfortable with Case Keenum for a little while, I mean, there's a lot of options there, but I do like that philosophy where it's more of a, it's not just trading up to get the name that you just want today. It's more like building for the future by accumulating more draft picks and letting someone else take that risk. And maybe that risk works out, but for the most part, it seems those risks don't.
Without question, though, Lee's client, Paxton Lynch, is going to go near the top of the draft. I mean, he's,
He's an impact guy. I think that probably, you know, if you look at the first round of the draft, the Browns, I would guess, are going to go quarterback. I would guess that it's also likely that the Cowboys could be looking for an heir apparent to Tony Romo. The Eagles are certainly looking quarterback. And the Rams are potentially looking quarterback. So, you know, I think those are sort of the plays for quarterback in the first round. But I there's no question that, that Lee's client, Paxton Lynch, I didn't realize he's 6'7".
Yeah. 12 inch hands.
Yeah. I mean, 6'7" and those hands. That's an incredible size, and a unique player. The guy I would love the Rams to look at is, Laquon Treadwell, who's the wide receiver from Ole Miss. Who's probably the top player in the draft in terms of explosive ability on the offensive side of the football. You know, Tavon Austin came on towards the end of last season. Adding a guy like Treadwell can, you know, potentially give that offense some fire to go along with the pounding that Todd Gurley is going to deliver in those 300 or so carries this year.
Well, I think it was a great show with Lee Steinberg. If you go watch Jerry Maguire, Lee was basically the inspiration for that movie. So pretty cool stuff.
He's Tom Cruise played him in a movie.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty cool. But the show's not over though, Steve. We gave our
No, it's not.
And I wanted to, you got to tease something that you had on the radio today. We're going to put on the add to the podcast. So maybe talk about what that was.
Yeah. So myself and today filling in Andy Kamenetsky and O'Shea Jackson Jr. Star of Straight Outta Compton and a friend of ours who does a lot. He's Ice Cube's kid, does a lot of stuff with us. We got to talk to James Laurinaitis, who is, of course, he's been now, this will be his eighth year with the Rams, a stalwart on the Rams defense. And believe it or not, last year, this past season, became the all-time leading tackler in the history of the Rams franchise. Which is really saying something. So we talked to Laurinaitis about, Chris, he's an Ohio State guy, talked to him about, the move to LA, talked to him about the stability at quarterback and what direction he feels like the organization might take, and also talks about some of the key free agents, that are, on the defensive side of the football, for the Rams where, they're going to have to make some big decisions.
All right. Well, great stuff, Steve. We'll play that one for you now. So hopefully everyone enjoyed episode 3. We're kind of getting a rolling a little bit here on the Ramble On podcast. Got some good guests. We'll keep building up. We got a Hall of Famer, I think, lined up next, Steve. So that'll be fun for Rams fans.
Yeah, great, nostalgic, one of my all-time favorite players. Are we just going to leave it at that?
I think we should tease a little bit. Okay. That's fine.
Yeah, we're just going to tease one of my all-time favorite players and a Hall of Famer, Rams great, on the next Ramble On podcast.
All right, cool. And here's that interview with Steve Mason. And thanks so much for tuning into the Ramble On podcast. We will talk to you next time.
The second half of the NBA season gets underway as Kawhi Leonard and the Spurs aim to win their 7th straight, visiting Chris Paul and the Clippers. Coverage begins Thursday night at 9:30 Eastern on ESPN Radio. Mason in Ireland, right now.
We're gonna be all right. We're gonna be all right. We're gonna be all right.
One of the big winners last night, Kendrick Lamar. That's All Right off the Two Pimp a Butterfly album, which I actually thought was going to win Album of the Year. Taylor Swift beat him, but you guys actually announced, you and your dad, Kendrick Lamar's best rap album last night.
Yeah, Kendrick, you know, Straight out of Compton himself, and he was a huge supporter of the film, and I'm glad that I could be there when he wins that Grammy.
That performance was unbelievable.
Monster.
Just unreal.
Staggering great. He and in Chains, actually held the Chains over the microphone at one point there, and then the thing they did when the lights went out
and the fire in the background.
The fire in the back. That's as much fire as I've ever seen in a performance. I mean, that's just.
There were a lot of really good performances. Stevie Wonder's was really good.
Stevie Wonder was great.
That was the tribute to Maurice White. The Lionel Richie tribute was
I hated
really nice.
The Lady Gaga for David Bowie thing. That was lame.
It was. It was a review. I mean, yeah. It basically was Bowie mania, and yeah. They should have just let her do one song, yeah. Which I think she would have been fine. I think right. She would have been really good. The tribute to B.B. King was great.
Was great.
That was really
some
good.
People I never heard of, like Ellie Goulding, who sang with, I don't know who that was, that girl from San Diego, but they just tore it up. James Bay and whoever the hell he was singing with was great. Like these, they're all very happy. I remember their names.
Yeah, you're killing.
Oh, and the
Hamilton.
The Hamilton was terrific.
Oh my God.
I went to New York to see that.
How
that
is it?
Amazing.
Yeah.
You know, when I first sat down, they were like, yeah, we want you to go see this play on Alexander Hamilton, and it's like a rap opera. I was like, all right, I'm offended that you guys just think that I'm like this.
Yeah.
And so
you always say, where's my Mumford and Sons?
Yeah. You know, it's just like, all
but
right.
But Lin-Manuel Miranda, like, I've been a fan of for a long time. Well, I want to bring that up later on. But right now, we've got the leading tackler in the history of the Rams franchise. Now moving to Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Rams and an anchor for this defense, James Laurinaitis is on the line. What's up, James? How are you, man?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Excellent. Excellent. So my family grew up rooting for you, James, because they're all from Ohio, grew up in Toledo, Ohio, so all Buckeye fans. So they knew you from your college days, and, of course, you've been an anchor on this Rams defense. Talk about your feelings about coming to L.A.
Well, I'm excited. I think, you know, every time we've played on the West Coast, we've had numerous L.A. Rams fans kind of show up for games. A game that really sticks out was when we played the Chargers, not last season, but the season before, and we had, goodness, probably 20,000 fans there, and it was awesome just to kind of have support on the road and kind of feel the excitement. And so looking back, you know, last year we were up in Oxnard for training camp and seeing the people that showed up for when we went against the Cowboys was very impressive. And, you know, it's going to be an exciting transition and just ready to get the offseason program started.
What was it like for you guys playing this season with the uncertainty of where you'd be this coming season over your head? I know guys like to say they don't think about it, but as you said, you opened the camp in Oxnard. So it was like from the beginning, this was the story.
Yeah, and goodness, it was very much. I'll say when you're game planning and stuff, when you're at the building, you're not thinking about it, but it's impossible to block it out altogether. You're right. You have family members who are asking constantly. You have friends who are always asking you. So no matter how much you personally try to block it out, or you know, don't read anything on it, or whatever. You know, luckily you have the distraction of football during the fall, but you know, the whole summer leading into the fall and the whole little period afterwards until the vote was very much one of those things where you're like, look, I don't have anything to do now, so I wonder if we're going or staying. And I think just because it's such a big transition, you know, you're going from the middle of the country all the way out west, there's a lot of things that kind of, you know, you have to get the ball rolling on with selling a home or moving, and a lot of questions. Definitely wondered about it once the season stopped.
James, you're going to be entering your James Laurinaitis from the Los Angeles Rams is with us. You're going to be entering your eighth season with the Rams. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, eighth season with the Rams. And Les Snead and Jeff Fisher, they've built a really, really young team. You're one of the most veteran guys on that roster. I would assume, you know, what's your role as kind of being a team leader like?
Well, you know, I've just always tried to lead by example. I'm not too much of a rah-rah guy. I'm, you know, if guys get out of line, usually that discipline comes from the top. You know, you reinforce the coach's messages. Ever since I've been in high school, I've always just wanted to pride myself in being a guy that, you know, when coach goes to sleep at night, he doesn't have to worry about whether I would be ready to play or not or whether I'd be prepared. I always wanted to be the most prepared guy. So I really just try to work the hardest in the weight room. If we're supposed to be there at a certain time, I'm there. If it's recommended to do a little extra in the workout, I'm doing a little extra. I'm doing the little things that a real pro would do. And I've really tried to kind of be that way my whole career. And I learned my rookie year from O.J. Otagwe, who was a vet at the time with the St. Louis Rams. And he said, treat every year like you're a rookie and you'll never get complacent. Just keep reproving yourself. And that's what I try to do every single offseason. I know for a fact that every spring they go through, they look at the roster, they kind of give a value on every single player, and every spring I just try to be proved to the organization that I'm worth having on the team.
The Rams the last few years have been that very popular sleeper team among pundits, you know, like the team that's about to break through. And you guys have basically been pretty consistently around 500 every one of those years. In your mind, what's sort of the next step for you guys to really break through? What's sort of missing and needs to happen?
Yeah, you know, quite honestly, we need to beat teams that we should beat teams that on paper that we're supposed to beat. I know football, they're always going to have, you know, a couple games where you're like, how'd that team beat that team and whatnot. But we, you know, we swept the Seahawks last year, but then we lose some games, and I don't want to name teams for that. Both of our stuff, but we lost some games where, quite frankly, you know, it's embarrassing that we lost to. We lost 3 games in overtime this last season that are really close football games that we got. We win overtime games, you know, goodness, we're able to crack at the playoffs there. So you have to just grow up and mature in the sense that you need to be able to go. We have to go on the road and play a team that, say, we have a 4-0 start, you know, and they're 1-3. And we're a better football team. We got to win our game and not just barely squeak it out, but kind of dominate the football game for 60 minutes and learn how to do that and go on a streak of 3 or 4 games. So we've been close, and I think people keep picking us to kind of get over the hump because of how talented we are at all the positions. But until we put it on the field and start winning those games, you know, the same result's going to happen. So we got to figure it out.
James, I heard you say to continue to look at things like a rookie. Speaking of rookies, what does Todd Gurley bring to the team? And more importantly, the offense with our quarterback situation in flux?
Yeah, look, man, Todd is just, he's a rare breed. He's one of those guys that athletically is super gifted and blessed, but he's also a very humble kid and really his ability to be a home run threat. I mean, I was there when I was young. I was there with Steven Jackson, and Steven was always a very physical runner and got tough yards. But when Steven would break a run, you know, very rarely you've seen it go 60, 70 without wondering if someone was going to track him down. And that's not saying anything against Steven Jackson. I mean, he's the all-time leading rusher there in St. Louis. But Todd, you never think anyone can catch him. He's super explosive, great top-end speed. And to think that he did all that last year with really rehabbing his leg and his knee and not having a whole offseason like he will this year to kind of build it and strengthen it to really come out strong again, you know, it's exciting to think about kind of how he'll do the next few years, and definitely he'll be a star in the league for a long time.
O'Shea referenced the quarterback situation being in flux. We talked to Les Snead, your general manager, a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about, of course, Nick Foles is under contract. Case Keenum finished strong, 3-1 in those last 4 games of the season, including, I think, a win over Seattle. Also, Sean Mannion, who was a rookie last year out of Oregon State, who I saw play a lot here on the West Coast. What do you think the odds are that next year's starting quarterback is on the roster right now?
Man, I have no idea.
I know. I'm pinning you in there, James.
You're not the GM. Remember this, James.
No, it's fine. I have no idea. I mean, there's things happen. I would say the odds are pretty high, but then again, things, trades happen, and people get released and moved and drafted and all these things. I mean, so many things happen in an off season that are just totally unexpected. I mean, there's things that are rumored and things come out of left field. So I don't know. I think our regime has proven to make some pretty bold moves. You look at the move, you know, dealing Sam for Nick. You look at the move, the RG3 trade. I mean, they've wheeled and dealed before. Who knows what's going to happen, quite frankly. But thankfully, I only like to worry about, you know, the guys on my side of the rock and try to make sure we got all of our stuff in order, and we got a ton of free agents to be, and so hopefully we can sign the guys back.
From the Rams, James Laurinaitis online with us, Mason in Ireland, ESPN LA. Andy?
I guess piggybacking on to Mace's question, is there a particular style of quarterback that you think works best for your offense? That was actually something Mace and I were debating yesterday about, like, who really would be the best fit for you guys.
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I think there's so many different styles of you know, you see what Russell does and how he can kind of improv. I'm not sure that's what fits our offense. You know, you got the prototypical guys as well. And I think really with the guys that we have on our roster, you see different styles. I mean, Nick is, you know, the tall pocket passer, and Sean's definitely that way too, where they're going to stand upright and try to just use their arm to kind of throw it around. And Case, you know, definitely is a gunslinger himself, but he also has a little mobility to him and is kind of, you know, has that ability to scramble around, make a throw, or pick it up off with his feet. So I'm not really sure. I think either style can work for us. You know, I just think we need not only more consistent play there, but also more consistent play around them and whoever's that QB. So early on in the season, we had, you know, the young old line trying to learn how to play in the league and pick up on everything, and they got tremendously better as the year went on, and I'm excited about the young guys that we have on the front on offense, and obviously Todd Gurley seems to help, you know, whoever's at QB and the playmakers on the outside with Tavon getting better, and we'll see with Kenny Britt and you know, hopefully still praying that Stedman Bailey makes a full recovery and is able to come back, and you know, so everyone's got to up their game and then pick it up for us to kind of get over that hump.
Talked about the quarterback situation in flux. You also have a lot of free agents on defense. At cornerback, Truman Johnson, Janoris Jenkins. At safety, Rodney McLeod and Mark Barron. Mark Barron, I think, led the team in tackles last year. Robert Quinn, defensive end. That uncertainty must be, I mean, these are guys who are anchors on that defense. How do you deal with the fact that, you know, we're moving into free agent season and there are potentially changes, guys who will stay and guys who will go?
It's hard. I mean, the turnover is so just fast in the NFL that you're just constantly dealing with new people plugging in, and you got to try to build the young guys to replace certain guys. And realistically, you know, we want to bring everyone back. Now, are we able to do that financially? Are we able to do that? I just don't know. And that's the hard part, because you build relationships with all your teammates. And so personally, I want them all back. I know exactly what all those guys have done for us. Like you said, Mark Barron has made a huge impact with us. I mean, Rodney McLeod is one of my favorite teammates, and Eugene Sims, Will Hayes, and our two corners are, I mean, I'd argue that as a tandem, I mean, we could have the best tandem in the NFL, and I might be biased, but I know other guys have maybe a better top guy, but their number two guy isn't as talented as say, Janoris or True, some of it together. They're a heck of a tandem. And so it's hard. You know, it all depends on who the staff prioritizes and what the money kind of shakes out. But I know that everybody on that defense loves playing for Greg Williams and loves playing for Jeff Fisher. So hopefully that helps us.
All right. Hey, listen, James, thanks a lot for coming on. Really appreciate it. We're looking forward to seeing you at I guess your OTAs are going to be in Oxnard. We'll be up there following you, and we appreciate you coming on a lot, man. Welcome to L.A.
Absolutely. Thank you. Look forward to seeing you guys.
Cool. Thanks, James. James Leonardis, who is an anchor and does now, after last season, became the all-time leading tackler in the history of the Rams franchise, which is saying something.
That's amazing.
Balling. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Really amazing.
It's a lot of history, and he is the leader. All right, coming up for you, I want to talk about the Ronda Rousey thing, which is really, really disturbing. Our three-man weave today, O'Shea Jackson Jr., yeah. Andy Kamenetsky.
The second half of the NBA season gets underway as Kawhi Leonard and the Spurs aim to win their seventh straight, visiting Chris Paul and the Clippers. Coverage begins Thursday night at 9:30 Eastern on ESPN Radio.